Okay, you're welcome back. Any questions left over from what we just talked about before we go on?
I was thinking about the comment you met when you were speaking with the young people on the train. And the Amish. You said the women won't speak with the men. So I'm interested in this whole history you just laid out for us. Maybe. What was the role of the woman in the
year? Well, always in a lesser capacity.
Yeah,
they had to advance that much in consciousness. That was to make women equal to men. You've heard the expression, he's a devout Catholic.
Indeed.
And I asked myself, because I've heard about, you know, political figures. Now that we have various Catholics in political offices, but yet they would still vote for war. And so it makes you wonder, what does devout Catholic mean? Probably means goes to Mass on Sunday.
Every day, every
day. Or daily. Doesn't eat meat on Good Friday. I mean, it's a very, shall we say, washed out version of what the Christian message is about. So when you go to church and you have never gotten it that we stand for something that's different from what the political system stands for often. And remember in our childhood there were two flags, there was the American flag and the Catholic flag. As if they're equal. And that we're supposed to be loyal to both. But our loyalty did not mean take a stand against any policies that don't support justice, peace, and love. So that never quite came through. So let's contrast being a religious person. I remember high school, I was always described as, oh, he's very religious. Mm-hmm. And religious meant I would go to Mass every day, of course, and I had, you know, holy pictures in my bookmarks, and I had statues of Christ and Mary in the house, and that was considered religious. But what about being evangelical? This is the Greek word for gospel. Evangelical would be I will no longer operate from the primitive reaction of retaliation. I will open myself to the grace of doing good to those who hate me, blessing those who persecute me, pray for those who mistreat me. And that would be the spiritual alternative. That would be a conversion to gospel teaching. So you've heard the expression, he's a convert to Catholicism. When I was a priest, one of my jobs was to, this is one of the best jobs I ever had. The pastor said to me, there are six people who want to become Catholics, and would you do the instructions? I said, here's my chance. So I had my little six people, and I, you know, told them about the Sermon on the Mount, and take a stand against Vietnam, and that type of stuff. And I didn't go into any of the other, you know, follow all the rules from Rome. And I thought, here's my chance to produce actual converts to the full gospel teaching without anybody ever knowing. So I hope they're still staying with it. So It would be conversion to this gospel teaching and then to cultivate it by practice with the help of grace. Then when people hurt you, it's a chance to practice your religion. What religion? Your evangelical religion. And this will never happen as long as we want a religion that fits into society. Amish don't want to fit in. They've noticed fitting in means giving up your gospel commitment. And it occurred to me that most of us Catholics come from immigrants whose first purpose is to fit in. Fit in. Whereas the other groups did not put accents on fitting in. So one transition that we would need to make is to move from putting all the accents on what you're supposed to believe to what is most beneficial as a way of living. So no longer collaborating with the world of oppression, war, and hate. No longer collaborating and trying to get in on more power, more wealth, and more privilege. The alternative to the greed, hate, and injustice is what the Sermon on the Mount offers. Imagine this description of a person of faith by Ernst Renan, R-E-N-A-N. Quote, "The person of faith is torn with discontent and possessed with a passionate thirst for the future." What is the future? The Messianic kingdom of justice, peace, and love. I'm torn with discontent about the way the world is. And I'm possessed with a passionate thirst to make it better. He says that's what it means to have faith. Mm.
David?
Yeah.
A quote, and I forgot where they said, one of the fathers saying, when the church loses its mission, it concentrates on doctrine.
Yeah. And take refuge in what are the proper dogmatic pronouncements. And a lot of that was what we inherited as our Catholic experience. The accent was put on what you're supposed to believe in accord with what Rome has defined. They could have put all that energy into brainwashing us into the Sermon on the Mount.
Yeah.
But instead it went into how can you align yourself to the authorities. Which reminds me that for some of us, faith was very connected to loyalty. And this is especially true when you look at our American Catholic experience, because we were not only brought up to be Catholic, we were brought up to be Irish Catholic, where the accent is on very, very firm loyalty to Catholicism, which in Ireland is associated with nationalism. So you're going to take a stand against the English Protestants and you're going to remain a Catholic. And we were brought up with that kind of life. And I can certainly see that in myself. I can see that no matter what, I couldn't really leave the church and join another church, even if it totally followed the Sermon on the Mount. I couldn't say, well, I'm not a Catholic now, I'm a Quaker. I would rather act like a Quaker, but still have this name. And they drilled it into me so much that even now, after all these years, I can't let go of it. Mm-hmm. The other night I was watching this program that they had on Showtime called The Tudors, which is about the end of the 8th and this break with Rome. And they had the, they showed the trial of St. Thomas More, who was the former Chancellor of England and Henry's best friend. But he took a stand against Henry wanting to annul the marriage with Catherine and marry Anne Boleyn. So you would know the story. And he would not take the oath that would support the new arrangement, which would be that the king is now the head of the church, not the pope. So anyway, he was in court, and he was making his statement. The first half of the statement was this: I believe that every person should follow his own conscience. I thought, good, that I agree with. Then he added, and that the only way to know that you have the true doctrines is if it's approved by Rome. And I said, no, I'm not going that far. I mean, he just hadn't, and you can't expect him to have, but he hadn't made the move from the idea of the true faith and loyalty. For to him, it was loyalty to Rome. So, I mean, that's his own conscience, so no problem. But you see my, what I'm bringing up? That it's important for us to ask ourselves, are we still there, mm-hmm. or have we moved?
So that experience of yours is the same experience that I had. That, you know, you're a Catholic forever. There's a guy, Bishop Fulton Sheen, who had a radio TV program back in mm-hmm. the 50s. And he was very popular with Catholics and non-Catholics. Had a tremendous sense of humor. But he said, give me a child before the age of 5 and he will be a Catholic forever. And that's the brainwashing.
The brainwashing.
That's the brainwashing.
That's right.
It's very therapy.
I think today with the search for identity, the talk, especially Catholic identity, what does it mean to be Catholic, or what does it mean to be Protestant or Baptist? In a world that's already so divided along these kind of lines, I'm wondering if, since globally we're becoming more one, if the more important question is, what does it mean to be human? On this planet as one species, what does it mean to be human? And what does being Catholic help me to understand about what it means to be human? And so I, too, would never think of not wanting to be Catholic, but the bigger question for me is not being Catholic, but what does my experience in Catholicism have to do or have to offer in bringing together the whole human community? And then to look at what does it mean to be Protestant or Methodist? What does your own experience contribute to our one story? And honoring that, you know, and not expecting that everybody should only be Catholic or only have one story. We have many stories to contribute, and we all have something to offer, and each is an important piece. So to focus just on Catholic identity, what does it mean to be Catholic? Your starting point has to be over against, well, I'm Catholic because I'm not this, or I'm not that, or I'm not this. You can't start there because all the boundaries get drawn. To me, it's we're all human, and what does our experience in our particular religious tradition have to contribute to our understanding of what it means to be human in today's world? Mm-hmm. And Catholicism certainly has something wonderful. Many wonderful things to offer in that story. So,
sure.
But to say, what does it mean to be Catholic, and this whole argument about Obama and Notre Dame and Catholic identity, it's just continuing to draw the boundaries and the borders that cause the friction.
Separate, right? It reminds me of, like, a simple statement from the Gospel, that they all may be one.
Mm-hmm.
That's you and I are one, Father. but they all may be one. In our childhood meant that everybody become Catholic. Mm-hmm. That they all be one now means that we all get along. Mm-hmm.
And of course,
that's a big change.
He spoke that as a Jew.
Anyway, right.
You know, he said, yeah, I mean, Jesus was Jewish, you know, not Catholic.
Okay, other comments? I thought that it's always important in our work to look at Teilhard de Chardin, because he's our great pioneer in all this. And he talks about Christ as the evolver, the one who evolves the universe, the center toward which all moves. And that, he says, the issue today is not about Christ and the Trinity. The issue is a new Nicaea, and one that brings together the terrestrial and cosmic nature of Christ, as opposed to Christ as the second person of the Blessed Trinity. Not that you have to deny that or let go of it, but your accent, your emphasis changes, so it becomes that Christ has the same nature as the cosmos, and he holds it all together. And he referred to the Sacred Heart as the heart of matter, the heart of the universe, basically. And this is one of his quotes. Through the symbol of the Sacred Heart, the qualities of fire capable of transforming anything and everything happens through the power of its love energy. The heart of Jesus moves the world forward into the future and unites people around a new personal center, which is love. And I have a quote from Wisdom's Way that helps. This is from Teilhard. Beneath our individual strivings toward becoming more spiritual, the world slowly accumulates, starting with the whole of matter, that which will make of it the heavenly Jerusalem or the new earth. The only human embrace capable of worthily enfolding the divine is that of all people opening their arms to call down and welcome the fire. The only subject ultimately capable of mystical transfiguration is the whole of humanity forming a single body and a single soul in love. We shall never know all that the incarnation expects of the world's potential. We shall never put enough hope in the growing unity of humankind. We'll never be able to hope enough. I'm on page 124. We'll never be able to hope enough in how unified we could be, that they all may be one. And we'll never know fully how much the incarnation expected of us to be human. It gives us the full picture of what it means to be human, which the Church has nicely defined for us. It's human hyphen divine. That's the full potential of humanity. And the Sermon on the Mount describes the human divine style in a very specific way, which is different from the way the world describes the fullness of humanity. So if you go to Freud and ask, well, what's the fullness of humanity? He has a very clear answer, which is, you know, psychology 101. It's to be able to feel self-esteem, to have healthy relationships, and to be engaged in some kind of work that fulfills you and contributes to society. So what does it mean to be fully human from a psychological point of view? Self-esteem, good human relationships, good and healthy relationships, and work that fulfills you and contributes to society. But we have been challenged to say that this description with these three components don't go far enough. And that if you want to be fully human, it's human divine, as in the incarnation, and your way of living is not just contribute to society, but to turn society into a kingdom of justice, peace, and love. It's a whole other approach. And Karl Rahner, he's the great German theologian, said that evolutionary change occurs because a power that comes from within us works together with pressure from the divine, acting from within. And this pressure from within is God, who is the same as the evolutionary thrust toward fulfilling our potential. Isn't that a great definition of God? It's the impulse toward self-transcendence. And he believed that openness of the cosmos to what is new, when you have that openness to what's new, you gain the capacity to leap forward with it, and this leads to the emergence of a new kind of being, a being that's more like the incarnate Christ. And that human nature assumed by Christ is the equivalent of what the evolutionary purpose is that we would all be human divine. So here's a quote from Zachary Hayes. We discover in the deeper sense, in what we see and hear and touch in Jesus, the divine clue as to the structure and meaning of our own humanity and of the whole universe. Look at Jesus, he's a clue. Oh, that's what we're meant to be like. Oh, we look like that. As opposed to just going for such low stakes and looking like what Freud offers as the picture of the full human. Jim?
Is the human divinity of Gandhi, what was going on between him and the English?
You mean,
is that the divine pressure?
Yes.
That you refer to?
Yes. That divine pressure is the dynamics that work together. So how does he redeem? He redeems by evolving. Evolving what? Evolving the whole world in the direction of justice, peace, and love. So one last quote. Christ as the heart of change in the universe and Christian life. If we are to remain faithful to the gospel, this is Teilhard de Chardin, we have to adjust its spiritual code to the shape of the universe. It has ceased to be the formal garden from which we were banished by a whim of the Creator, and instead has become the great work in process of completion that we see all around us. For the Christian is now discovering that he or she cannot be saved except through the universe and by continuing it. It's a whole new definition of salvation. When we're joining into the forces of evolution, that's the equivalent of knowing you're saved. Doesn't he have an exciting view? Okay, other questions about this?
Is that a particular paper that...
I just found some other quotes from Teilhard that I didn't have in my other book. By the way, I checked the Book of Common Prayer, which is the main liturgical book in the Episcopal Church, and I found this quote, which fits so well with the Sermon on the Mount. This is from the Great Litany. That it may please thee to forgive our enemies, persecutors, and slanderers, and to turn their hearts, we beseech thee, to hear us, good Lord. That's the same concept. And I guess the question is, will it become our teaching also? Will this become the style that we're going to operate from? Okay, well, we only have a few minutes left, so are there any final questions about this before I start winding up? Yeah?
I just realized something. This idea of reacting to something versus accepting an evolution and living in a larger place, when you were doing the teaching in the church, sort of this idea of understanding what the Quakers did within the home you lived in, because if you can't somehow enlarge those boundaries, what happens to even these splinter groups? It seems to me, I'm thinking of an evangelistic movement that was that became a delusionary place. It was just another place to hide. That when these groups are in reaction to Catholicism or authority, whatever is pushing them aside, then they become the same. They're doing the same thing in another dress, but what you did was you evolved within the place you lived. Because even, I'm worried about groups like the Quakers even, they have this beautiful philosophy, but if they're too isolated, and they have to build their walls so high that they have to protect themselves so no one can look in, and they can't look out, then they don't grow either. So there is this...
That's the dynamics, where we're always brushing with the society. Our church definitely allows us to do that.
Yeah. I would be fascinated to learn and read more about it. Did you think, is there any application of quantum theory to divine energy and the interconnectedness of energy in the universe? I think I'm going to order this program from the teaching company about quantum theory. And it's 24 lectures on quantum theory and quantum mechanics and about energy. And I think they even get into some stuff like ESP and so on. And I just find the topic fascinating. I know very little about it.
And there's also a book by Dermot O'Merchan called Quantum Theology. I read that. And I found it very helpful.
Michael Morwood has written several books, a series of books that deal with this whole idea of our present cosmology and the quantum universe and so on, that are very good. And he takes you through belief in God and Christianity and so on, and how that might affect, really in many ways should affect, our way of seeing and believing.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael Morwood, I know, is available on Amazon.
Yes, he's excellent. Jim?
I was thinking, as you spoke, Jim, of Barbara Marks Hubbard.
Yes.
And having someone locally here that could help expand this particularly because coming from first from an atheistic, very scientific place to moving into the big cosmic Christ and searching for an expression of that and recognizing how all the different spiritualities and traditions have preserved something and have encapsulated something, and yet there's not a place where, when you don't fit into that anymore, the new spirituality has not evolved yet.
Mm.
And
we're like between.
Yeah,
that's a good point. We haven't had the full blossoming of the cosmic Catholicism, as it were. But Ginny and Alice are helping us get there. You're helping us move in that direction. I admire you and how you keep at this.
Well, it's not easy.
I know. But you got to be our pioneer and show us the way.
Well, one of the things that Tamar and others are doing that I think is so important for where we are today is, to me, he reconciled just within himself in his own life what I call the mother of all divorces, and that's between spirit and matter, between God and the world. That was the big thing for him. He felt a call to religious life, and in his day, that meant forsaking the world. But he was a nature mystic, and he found God in the world. And so he felt like he had to make a choice. And it wasn't until he discovered the evolutionary model, not Darwin's, but a French scientist called Henri Bergson, who said that he believed in evolution, but said that there was what he called a vital force running through all of evolution, which for Teilhard would be the Christ, bringing us to where we are today. So he brought together spirit and matter. And so what Christianity has largely been up to this point is an evacuation plan from this world to the next. And what Teilhard is saying is it's this world. He said, even if I lost faith in God, I would still believe irremediably in the world, because this is where God, this is the locus of God's operation. So science, if you get into quantum physics, you get into biology, evolutionary biology, and you see what happens when a caterpillar transforms to a butterfly in the vaginal cells, and you just can take the veil off that, and it's a description of where we are today. Mm-hmm. So he's bringing together the two things that have been separate, and that Christianity tried to bring together in Christ, the incarnation. The incarnation happened from the beginning. It's coextensive with the whole of our evolutionary process. It didn't just happen 2,000 years ago. It happened in the beginning. So this is the excitement of the work of people like Teilhard and others, mm-hmm. that are bringing these two together, God and the world, where they were meant to be.
Yeah.
Where they are.
What strikes me is Alice is saying that it's always being there. I didn't have any Catholic education, but my mother must have been in her soul somewhere back there with the Sermon on the Mount Catholic, because she lived the gospel. She was tough. She had the gun. She didn't shoot, but she always thought she might. the biggest formation I had in my life was seeing that in the midst of all kinds of homelessness, big family, poverty, seeing that kind of steering through all that from this simply identifying with where other humans were at the moment. And it's astounding to me that I'm just now really realizing that was the basis of her faith. I remember one time we had a priest up at the house, and he said, "Where do you think you got your faith?" I said, "I got it from my mother." "I have no doubt," he said. "You got it from the church. And you say, you get rid of that notion. Well, I was under authority. I tried as hard as I could to get rid of that notion. I couldn't. Mm-hmm. It was experiential. Mm-hmm. It was true, and it was real. And to me, she already was an evolutionary and mm-hmm. didn't know one. Didn't mm-hmm. have a clue.
Good for you. You had a question? Did you ever come?
Oh, I was at, when we were talking about ecumenism there, I thought of something happening in the past. Hmm. I always thought, this is way back, ecumenism was always like a bunch of people of different beliefs coming together and melting down what they have to come together with some kind of glob of something. And I had to be participating in a retreat format. It was definitely from a Christian Catholic ethic, but it was attracting Jews and all sorts of other, because it wasn't conversionary. If you're not trying to convert anybody, it was expressing. And it culminated with Mass, and it was just Mass. It wasn't really a part of the thing, but because there's a lot of Catholics there.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, one at one of these, there was a Protestant minister and his wife there, and he came up to me after before Mass began and said, "You know, I'd like to receive communion. Can I receive communion?" And I said, "Who made me God?" Right away, you know. So I said a little prayer under my breath, and this is what came out. I said, "You know, I don't really make that decision, but the very fact that you ask might be your answer."
Mm-hmm.
And he got very upset, even though I didn't say anything. And he wanted to leave, and his wife convinced him to stay. And they stayed on the peripheral in the back. And anyway, after that, everybody was leaving. And he came up to the couple of people who had said that to him at the beginning. And he said to me, he said, "You know, thank you for saying that." And I said, "I didn't really say it, you know." And he said, "I never felt more," whatever he was, "during, except at the time of the Eucharist during the And I think that's what, we should not be conversionary, but we should share who we are and what our beliefs are and how we lead our life. And then I had this experience with a Jewish man once. I walked away from a conversation with him and I said, "Am I as good a Catholic as this guy is a Jew?" You know? And that's, I think that's what it's all about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it was, we didn't talk about rules and regulations, you know, we talked about spirit side.
Yeah. Okay, any other final questions before we wind up? Okay, I just want to share one quotation and then we'll have our final comment. This is from a modern version of the Bible, and I thought you'd enjoy hearing. This is Luke chapter 6, 27. So this is the part of the Sermon on the Mount, but in modern English. "To you who are ready for the truth, I say this. Love your enemies. Let them bring out the best in you, not the worst. When someone gives you a hard time, respond with the energies of prayer. If someone slaps you in the face, stand there and take it. If someone grabs your shirt, gift wrap your best coat and make a present of it. If someone takes unfair advantage, use the occasion to practice being a servant. No more tit for tat. Live generously." Well, I'd like to thank everybody for being here, and this was a wonderful experience for me, and I hope you got something out of it. Thank you.